From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness.
Donald Trump has defeated Vice President Kamala Harris after she has secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. This comes 4 years after Trump attempted a coup to stay in power and after he was impeached twice and convicted in court. The Republicans have also regained control of the Senate, the House still up for grabs. We'll examine results and look at what 4 more years of a Trump presidency means for the country and the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump is headed back to the White House after defeating Vice President Kamala Harris following a campaign where he vowed to retaliate against his critics and to carry out the largest mass deportation of immigrants in U.S. history. As of this broadcast, Trump secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. Harris has 224 electoral votes. The race was called for Trump after he won the critical swing states of Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Trump's also leading in Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona. Trump is the first convicted felon and at 78 years, the oldest candidate ever elected president. He appears on pace to win the popular vote for the first time after receiving far fewer votes than Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. Trump's victory comes as the Republican Party has clinched control of the U.S. Senate, shifting the balance of power on Capitol Hill. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice won the race to fill the seat vacated by Senator Joe Manchin. In Montana, Republican Tim Sheehy is projected to have beaten the incumbent Democrat, John Tester. In Ohio, Republican Bernie Moreno has defeated Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. In Nebraska, Republican Senator Deb Fischer held off a challenge from independent Dan Osborne. And the Republicans could win several more Senate races. It remains unclear which party will control the House of Representatives. But in Delaware, Democrat Sarah McBride has been elected the first openly transgender Congress member in U.S. history, defeating Republican John Whelan. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, Tuesday in a surprise move that triggered large-scale protests across Israel. Gallant had publicly disagreed with Netanyahu over a temporary deal to exchange Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. He also insisted Israel carry out a full investigation into the failures that led to Hamas's October 7th attack, something Netanyahu rejected. Netanyahu appointed Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz to succeed Gallant. Katz recently led a successful campaign to cancel Israel's agreements with UNRWA. That's the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. In the Gaza Strip, 4 Palestinians were killed when Israeli troops shelled a home southeast of Khan Yunis. Elsewhere, an Israeli airstrike leveled an apartment building in Gaza City, killing 5. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, to talk more about Donald Trump's victory over Kamala Harris and what it means for the country and the world, we are joined by 3 guests. John Nichols is the nation's national affairs correspondent. He's joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin voted for Trump. Rami Khoury is a Palestinian journalist, a senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. and in Philadelphia, we're joined by Kianga Yamata-Taylor, professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. Professor Taylor is contributing writer at The New Yorker magazine. Kianga Yamata-Taylor, let's begin with you in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, which has been decided. Pennsylvania has gone to Trump. Can you share your response to what has taken place?
Well, I have to say that it's on some level, it's shocking that someone like Trump could be back in this position, but it's not really surprising. I've written about really since the Democratic National Convention that the Democratic Party was playing a dangerous game that essentially downplaying the base in order to reach for new centrist voters to try to appeal to Republicans. And we can see with some of the preliminary exit polls that that was an abject failure, that Republicans voted for Republicans, Democrats voted for Democrats. But I think overall, the Democratic Party really underestimated the extent to which lots of people in this country are in crisis. I think that they have insisted for months from when Biden was running throughout that the economy is good, that they had overcome the issues with inflation, and that things were looking up. And those are the voters that they appeal to. But if you look at the exit polls, at least preliminary exit polls, there was a total washout with working class voters, people making between $30,000 and $50,000, people making under $100,000 went to Trump. And I think that there's a rise in homelessness, historic rise, historically high homelessness from 2023 to 2024 and on pace to exceed that this year. Rent is 20% higher today than it was in 2020. Hunger, insecurity on the rise compared to even just a year ago. And for even when the extent to the crisis doesn't express itself in that way, in the first quarter of this year, Americans took on $17 trillion in personal debt. And so this is completely unstable. And Kamala Harris had very little to say about that. She was running as an incumbent, trying to distance herself from those aspects of the Biden administration, but really unable to do so, really unwilling to chart a different course, to articulate how things would be different under her administration. And they are really, you know, we are seeing and dealing with the consequences of that today.
And Kianga, I wanted to ask you about the male-female divide, especially within the communities of color. There was a lot of talk early on in the pre-election polls about Latino and African American men gravitating more toward Trump. We don't know yet the turnout levels in these communities, but it does appear that there was a major shift among African American men. According to the exit polls, about 20% of them went for Trump, whereas among African-American women, it was over 90, I think 93% for Harris. And among Latinos, it was even more stark. According to these exit polls, a majority of Latino men voted for Trump, whereas two-thirds of Latino women voted for Harris. So there was a major, major gender gap in the Black and Latino communities. Wondering your thoughts about that.
I think that in terms of the extent of crisis that we see in this country that can be measured by employment rates, that can be measured by poverty rates, that can be measured by a sense of the quality of one's life, all of the barometers that we use to measured the mood of the country have really been in decline. And I think for men, for Black men in particular, they have felt the brunt of that. And I think that it has been largely dismissed. I think, you know, former President Barack Obama got lots of attention when he came out weeks ago and essentially dismissed those concerns as just sexism. And so I think, you know, I'm sure that that is part of the mix, but to reduce all of the economic anxiety of Black men and Black communities to sexism is, again, really to fail to capture. It's a failure to capture what is actually happening on the ground that is measured not just by the historic low unemployment that Biden and Harris have talked about, or by the historic low rates of poverty. But there is historically high sense of insecurity and a sense of not knowing what is actually going to come next. And I think that the Harris candidacy, that the Biden candidacy that preceded it, have really ignored the extent to which there has been continuity. Whether we go back from the Obama administrations to the Trump administration to Biden's administration, a continuity in insecurity, a continuity in uncertainty, a continuity in just not knowing what the future is going to hold, so much so that it builds a sense of cynicism that it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what, it doesn't matter how you vote. And then in another sense, I think that Trump satisfies something different because, to be honest, you know, the Republicans don't have any answers for that either. And Trump's policy proposals guarantee to make the situation worse for Black men, for Latino men. But what it does offer is an opportunity to give the finger, to thumb your nose at the status quo, at the condescension of someone like Obama, who just a week ago, I saw an ad that popped up on Instagram, and he's talking to a 20-something young Latino man and saying to this young voter who is trying to decide who he should vote for that, I know it looks like nothing has changed in your community, but you have to consider some woman was able to get her prescription. Someone else was able to get a bag of groceries. And it's like, what are we talking about? A prescription or a bag of groceries is not actually going to get it done. And so the low expectations that they offer of what we should hold, what we should have for elected officials is part of the problem, because the attacks on people, on people's incomes, the rising rate of rent, all of those things, ability to respond to that in a substantive way is part of what is driving this. And so the lower expectations doesn't actually instill confidence that Democrats can get, can make a difference in people's lives. And so that, I think, is the larger context to understand the small but significant defection to Trump.
You know, there's
I'd
an
like
interesting...
to bring John Nichols into the conversation. John, I wanted to ask you, particularly during the campaign, President Trump focused a lot of attention on immigration and on his threats to begin the biggest, the most massive deportation of undocumented in the country's history. Your sense of the results and what this will mean for the immigrant community and progressives overall in the coming weeks and months?
Look, this is a devastating result, and I think people have to recognize it. Donald Trump won by looks like a reasonably comfortable margin in the Electoral College when all is done, although there's still votes out, and I think we have to be a little careful about over-assessing it. It is possible he'll win the popular vote, although I still think there are a lot of West Coast votes out that will definitely make it closer and could even still tip it slightly against him. But what we've ended up with now is a situation where Donald Trump, as a president who has very few guardrails, has the potential to take horrific actions, which, remember, in his first administration, he tried to do as regards immigrants, refugees, working class people, people who, you know, are in difficult situations across the board. And so what we have to look at, and I think there's two things that are really important here. First, there's going to have to be a resistance to this. There's no question of that. But that resistance has to have at least some, hopefully, some traction on Capitol Hill. And that's where the results of the House and Senate races that are still very much in play become central to what we're talking about. The Senate is going to be Republican. It will have at least a 52-48 Republican majority, and that majority could well grow. There are still six seats that are undeclared. I think about four of them will go to the Democrats, maybe less, but I think there's a good possibility two of them will go to the Republicans. If the Senate is that wide a Republican majority, Trump is going to get easy approval for a lot of what he's doing. There may be some places where, as we talk about something like the immigration issue, there could be pushback. But to do that pushback, you would have to build a coalition, whatever Democrats are there, and to find at least some Republicans who wouldn't vote for a Trump cabinet pick or for a Trump initiative on, again, immigration, working class issues in general, all sorts of things. The only way that's going to happen is if there is tremendous organizing on the ground beginning now, today, in states where you have Republicans who have in the past broken with Trump, at least on some education and related issues, people like Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, Susan Collins up in Maine. But the real opposition ultimately is going to have to come in the House of Representatives. We don't know what's going to happen in the House. It is still very much up for grabs. There are 54 seats that are uncalled, much more than 10% of the House. If a majority of those seats, a good majority of those seats, goes to the Democrats, they've got the potential to be in a majority in the House of Representatives. It wouldn't be big, but they do have that potential. And this is not, you know, a foolish prospect to entertain, because most of the undeclared seats are on the West Coast, in California, Washington, Oregon. A lot of them will go Democratic. So we don't know where this is going to sort out, but this is the critical thing, Juan. If you get to a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives, then you have the next test, which is whether they feel beaten down and weakened and they just don't really want to fight. And they're saying, oh, we'll find ways to work with this new administration, blah, 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 things that they often say. Trump is going to take full advantage of that. And on the other hand, if they unite as a small but politically very powerful Democratic majority, that's where you can stop a lot of Trump initiatives. Again, as regards the House of Representatives, you've got to have vital organizing on the ground beginning now, so that if Democrats take control, they know that there are going to be people pressing them to do the right thing, to effectively be the opposition. And one final thing I'll say is, and Jamie Raskin and others have talked about this, Donald Trump has talked during this campaign about using the presidency in incredibly aggressive ways, not working with Congress, but just going on his own with executive orders and all sorts of other initiatives. This is something that has to be challenged in the courts and, to the extent possible, in Congress. I know people are, you know, deeply disappointed in the U.S. Supreme Court. I certainly am. But it is absolutely vital that there be court challenges wherever possible, because there are places in the states and at the federal level where you might be able to push back on some of what's going on. Bottom line, at this point, Republicans have a lot of power. Donald Trump has a lot of power. The only way to counter that is going to be organizing that is highly focused, that demands that those Democrats who are still in positions of some authority resist Donald Trump in a realistic and effective way. That's possible, but that is, as we know from history, not certain.
Interestingly, it's been raised that President Trump could nominate Aileen Cannon, the judge who dismissed the case against him, to the Supreme Court. And if the Senate, as it is, goes Republican, he might succeed in making her a Supreme Court justice. But I wanted to ask you, John, when you talk about people organizing right now, about a point that was raised during the Obama years. In the last months of the Obama presidency, there was a call for him to pardon undocumented migrants before Trump was sworn in. Trump is now promising mass deportations. The question is, could Biden preemptively pardon them? And what I mean by pardon, NYU Law Review, in the waning days of the Obama administration, with Trump's crackdown promised, over 100 advocacy organizations joined forces to urge President Obama to permanently protect hundreds of thousands of immigrants from deportation by pardoning their breaches of civilian immigration law. John Nichols.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Look, I am going to defer to the NYU Law Review and to the legal experts who have worked on these issues for years and know much more than I do about the specifics of how you would mount such a initiative. But what I can tell you is this, and this is the critical thing, I think, for progressives across this country to understand. The presidency is for 4 years. It is not for 3 years and, 10 months or something like that. The last months of a presidency have to be used in smart and effective ways. And you have to look at all the powers of the presidency. What that means is that Joe Biden has several months left in which to do what is right morally and politically. And there has to be, again, I think, pressure there. You know, we were just talking about, organizing on the ground as regards the Senate to put pressure on Republicans who might work with Democrats, organizing on the ground as regards the House to put Democrats to actually be Democrats, what Paul Wellstone used to refer to as the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. But then finally, there must be pressure on the ground and, even toward Washington on Joe Biden to make sure that he uses the last months of his presidency in a clear and effective, moral and politically smart way. And so what I would suggest to you is folks who are deeply frustrated or overwhelmed by these results have a right to be so. And I won't deny that. But I think that one important thing is to recognize that time matters in these struggles. And so if you are going to lobby members of the Senate, members of the House, and the president himself, you need to do that now, not wait, months until, January 20th or something like that. And again, what I would emphasize is there's a lot of organized groups across this country that are concerned about these issues. They have relationships with sitting members of Congress, with Republicans and Democrats. And they need to, they need to open those conversations, to have those town hall meetings, to have those protests, to have those marches, to speak truth to power in the way that it might yet be heard and might yet have an impact.
And I'd like to bring Kianga Yamada-Taylor back into the conversation. Kianga, your sense of what the potential steps now are for the progressive and resistance movement to this incoming administration?
Yeah, I think that we have a real problem. I mean, I appreciate the sentiment that John is expressing about the need to be mobilized and to resist now. But, activism and social movements don't often work like that. They're not water faucets where you just turn them off, and then when you need them, you turn them back on. I think that the movement, movements that we have understood them to be over the previous decade, with something like the Black Lives Matter social movement at its center, have been damaged and have been demobilized. I think in the last election in 2020, that there was so much focus on getting Biden elected and then winning those Georgia Senate races a few months later that the the whole focus of external pressure on elected officials was dissipated, and to such an extent that Biden faced no protest really until the end of the twilight of his term last spring, when the Palestinian solidarity movement exploded in a way, because it couldn't be co-opted by the Democratic Party in ways that these other social movements, not necessarily co-opted, but absorbed into the Democratic Party program. Organizers convinced that they had access to the Biden administration, that they had the ear of the Biden administration. And so I think that we actually have a lot of rebuilding to do. I don't think we're going to see the same initial response that we saw in 2017 with the Women's March and the immediate reaction to Donald Trump. There's a lot of rebuilding that has to be done.
We're talking to Princeton University professor Kianga Yamata Taylor. She's professor of African American Studies there. Kianga, I am looking at a Semaphore article from May 29th. It's headline, "A Dying Empire Led by Bad People. Poll finds young voters despairing over U.S. politics." And it starts off by saying, "Young voters overwhelmingly believe that almost all politicians are corrupt and that the country will end up worse off than when they were born, according to new polling from Democratic firm Blueprint, obtained exclusively by Semaphore." And I think it's interesting that you raise the protests around Palestine. In a minute, we're going to speak with the Palestinian-American journalist Rami Khoury. But the protests in the spring, that, you know, the encampments across the country, and this feeling that young people have, if you could comment on it, a dying empire led by bad people.
Look, there was a lot of focus on what would happen with Black voters, what would happen on other voters. Harris got wiped out on 18 to 29 year olds relative to Biden in 2020. I think she was down 22 to 24 points among the youngest voters. These are people who really have this sense of what does the future behold, right? These are young people whose entire lives have been shaped by American wars, American empire, American occupation. Many of them are saddled with debt that they cannot repay, debt that there are no jobs available to them that would allow them to repay it. They are faced with exponentially rising rents, laissez-faire housing market. And so it's a very dark, dystopic horizon for young people in this country. And some of the things that provided a sense of hope, you think about the 2020 protests that brought tens of millions of especially young people into the streets, that gave them a sense of vitality, that gave them a sense that they could actually influence the direction of politics and the direction of this country through their own self-activity and organization. And the way that those protests were siphoned into the presidential campaigns of 2020, and the way that people were actively demobilized and told that the access to the Biden administration could produce the goods that they wanted. And even as that was falling apart, even as the Biden administration was unable to follow through on the promises it made, no response, no leadership, no direction. And so that is something that is going to have to change, and that it's going to have to come from those people, those young people whose future looks very dark in the hands of others, but that they have the capacity to get organized. They have the capacity to be mobilized, and they have the capacity to change the direction of this country. And so this is a very grim, dark day. And I said before that I am shocked that this happened, but I'm not surprised. We could see the trajectory of this happening for the last 3 months. But this does not have to be the final chapter. But in changing the, turning the page and changing the story, we have to rethink lots of what we are doing in terms of our relationship as progressives, as part of the left, our relationship to the Democratic Party, our inability to act independently, to be completely tied to the electoral ups and downs, the electoral cycle of the Democratic Party. When we look at the actual policies and practices that they're pursuing.
Yeah, I wanted to bring John Nichols back into the conversation. John, the climate crisis, we have been faced, the entire world has been faced in the recent years with constant hurricanes, floods, forest fires. Now we're facing a Trump presidency where he was still using in his campaigns the slogan, drill, baby, drill. Your sense of what the climate, the movement to stem the climate crisis now faces in the United States?
Well, as my colleague says, this is a dystopian result. And where Donald Trump is coming from on these issues is not one of you know, even a traditional Republican kind of tip and a nod of the head to concerns about the climate, but then a decision to go where the fossil fuel companies tell you to go. This is a situation where Donald Trump has aggressively said and will make central to his agenda an effort to let fossil fuel companies do as they choose, to let the financiers who back them do as they choose. I mean, it really is devastating in this regard. And if I can just build on this, one thing relating to what was just said about Gaza, it is very important to note that people in Congress who stood up on Gaza, who spoke out on it, and who made it through primaries where AIPAC tried to defeat them, did very, very well yesterday. Bernie Sanders won by 2-1 up in Vermont. Ilhan Omar won with more than 70%. Rashida Tlaib, who did not endorse Kamala Harris, won with more than 70%. Greg Kassar in Texas won with almost 70%. Summer Lee, who is in a much more competitive district than some of these other folks, she won with a percentage, high 50s. And so the bottom line is that taking a strong stand on Gaza in this general election, that didn't hurt people. In fact, I think it may well have helped some candidates. And the same thing is true with climate. It's notable that everyone I just mentioned there who's been outspoken on the issue of Gaza, and some other folks, too, have been outspoken on Gaza, like AOC, have made climate very central to their service in Congress and other people who did well also. The problem here is with the leadership of the Democratic Party, because in this election, not only did they refuse to talk in any kind of consistent or effective way on the issue of Gaza, they also refused to talk in any consistent, effective way on climate. And, they would say occasional good things, but it wasn't as central as it needed to be. And then if we pause here and ask ourselves, okay, well, when we look at polling, when we look at anecdotal evidence, what are the issues that young people care about? Well, we hear about climate. We hear about Gaza. Certainly, we hear about racial justice. When you see that decline in support from young people, I think it's not that hard to explain. I think an awful lot of young people in this country simply did not hear what they needed to hear from the Democratic Party. And if they continue to have that silence or that lack of outreach on those issues, then I think you're in a situation where the Democratic Party is going to continue to struggle with what has been one of its most vital constituencies in recent years, and that's young voters.
This update, just as the House is up for grabs, Republican Mike Lawler of New York, and it looks like New York and California will determine the balance of the Senate. Republican Mike Lawler has defeated Mondaire. Will determine the balance of the House. The Senate has already been determined, and it is going to be a Republican majority. But in the House, Mike Lawler has defeated Mondaire Jones. I want to thank you both for being with us, John Nichols of The Nation and Kianga Yamata Taylor, professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. Coming up, we'll be joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian American journalist. And then we're going to look at referenda around the country and how they fared. Stay with us.
In the days of 39, oh, please leave the Vendana open. Federico Locker, dead and gone. Bullet holes in the cemetery wall. The black car of the Johnny of the beer. Spanish bombs on the Costa Rica. I'm dying in on a DC-10 tonight. Spanish bombs, you have to get a Benito.
Spanish Bombs by The Clash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. One of the first world leaders to congratulate Donald Trump on his presidential victory was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He wrote a message online that read, quote, "Dear Donald and Melania Trump, congratulations on history's greatest comeback. Your historic return to the White House offers a new beginning for America and a powerful recommitment to the great alliance between Israel and America. This is a huge victory. In true friendship, yours, Benjamin and Sarah Netanyahu." We're joined right now by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Rami Khoury, welcome back to Democracy Now!, your response to the Trump victory and what this means for Israel, Palestine, and for Lebanon and beyond.
I'm not surprised by the victory. We knew it was going to be very close, and we knew that a lot of voters were not precisely telegraphing what they were going to do. The nature of the whole electorate has changed. It keeps changing every 4 years due to many reasons. The main reason I think that Trump won is that he ran a campaign, much as people don't like him, for valid reasons usually. He did run a campaign that emotionally connected with not only his supporters, but a lot of other Americans. And Kamala Harris was a rank amateur. She had no idea what she was doing at that level of politics, which she showed 4 years ago when she ran in the primaries for the Democratic candidate, presidency candidate, and got nowhere. She didn't really touch on the issues that mattered, other than abortion and maybe immigration a little bit. But even there, she was just following Trump's lead. So it's no surprise. Many people are shocked. The trouble with Trump is that he's so unpredictable in many areas. But the difference between now and 4 years ago is that we've had 4 years of his presidency, and we've had 4 years of his being outside the presidency talking about issues. So he's not an unknown quantity like he was 8 years ago. Many of the things that he is going to do internally and internationally are predictable, I think. So I would just hold my horses and wait and see what happens. The last point I'd make is that the role of the Gaza-Israeli plausible genocide, as the International Court of Justice calls it, the role of that plausible genocide by Israel, which was heavily, heavily, enthusiastically, consistently and clearly supported by the United States, clearly had an impact. American people have shown now, as they did when I was in college in the late 60s, that they don't want their country being involved in a great war overseas that kills thousands and thousands of people that doesn't really relate to them. And this is a really powerful lesson. We can't draw the conclusions yet of exactly what the Gaza war did, but it clearly has mobilized a constituency that goes way beyond Arab and Muslim Americans. And I was in Dearborn, Michigan last weekend for 3 days at a convention of Arab Americans. And what I saw was really, really very, very powerful.
But Rami, how do you see the Trump administration changing policy in the Middle East in terms versus what Biden has done in the once it gets into office?
You know, one of the fascinating things about watching this stuff go on for half a century now, as I have, is there are little changes here and there. So last time Trump was in, he recognized Israel's sovereignty over Jerusalem, the annexation of the Golan Heights. He closed the PLO offices. He stopped funding UNRWA. He did all kinds of things that Palestinians don't like and justice supporters don't like and that Israelis like and evangelical right-wing American Christian fanatic supporters of Israel like. He did a lot of these things, and then Biden kept most of them. He didn't change really any of them significantly. And then Biden got involved in this incredible, plausible genocide, and Harris followed him completely. So I don't think there's really much change. Looking back, and empirically speaking, looking back over the last 40, 50 years, there are only minor cosmetic changes between Republican and Democratic administrations. The bottom line that all of them accept, with only the occasional minor adjustment, is that they will do almost anything that Israel wants for many reasons, which we don't have time to get into here. But the American political establishment is fully and enthusiastically supporting Israel, even in its plausible genocide. The American public is not. So there's a moral issue that came out of the American people over the last year and a half. And it was not just Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in Dearborn, Michigan. It was people all over the country, progressive Jews, labor unions, students, the student movement. So this is a movement that is still young. This is like Vietnam anti-war protests in 1965. It took a long time, another 7-8 years, to get the Vietnam War ended. And this is a similar situation. How it impacts Trump is not clear. This is where we have to really wait, because it's very hard to predict what Trump is going to do. He cares about two things. He cares about drama, entertainment, and he cares about making deals. And the deals may be political deals, and they're also commercial deals for him and his family and his cronies and his friends and his supporters. And that's what politicians do all over the world. It's nothing. There's nothing illegal about that. It's just how politics works in superficially democratic societies. But they are democratic, and the vote counts, and new people come to power, and they make deals, and they do dramatic things. Trump out-dramatized Harris, and that's why he won. He appealed to people's emotions, and that's how people vote. They don't vote on, you know, is our democracy threatened? That was a very important line from Harris and all her millions of supporters on the American mainstream television, who look like idiots now, because they were not, because the message is bad, because the message doesn't resonate with ordinary people all over the country, which is what we saw. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. I think the greatest arena that we should look at is that combination, which Trump sort of looked at a little bit, when he was president. Iran, Israel, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. That ring of powers that have, or they're not all powers, that ring of actors who all have important interests at play. He pulled out of the Iran agreement, the nuclear and sanctions removal agreement with Iran, and that this is one of the triggers that brought this situation of war in the region about. And he also did the Abrahamic Accords with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who knows about the Middle East as much as I know about underwater fishing in China, which is nothing. But the Abraham Accords are one of the things that set the stage for the continued conflict and the marginalization of Palestine, which set the stage for the October 7 attacks. So if they don't understand the connection among all of these issues and the growth of resistance movements in Yemen and Iraq and Lebanon and Palestine, if people don't understand that, they're just condemned to perpetual conflict. I think if somebody can explain to Trump that he can be a great hero by making a great hero to everybody by making a grand bargain that gives the Iranians, the Israelis, the Palestinians, the Saudis, everybody what they really want, which is to live in peace and a normal life. And I think it's attainable. I think it's possible, but you've got to have the level of smart, sensitive, and daring statesmanship, which we have not seen from Trump in a significant way. We've seen it very superficially, where it helps either his political constituents or it helps Jared Kushner's bank account in terms of deals, which he, of course, did with the Saudis. So this is the position we're in. We have to really wait and see, is a second Trump candidate presidency going to be more sophisticated and more meaningful than his first one? He is more experienced, and we'll just have to wait and
see.
On
Saturday, Rami Khoury, the Palestinian youth movement organized a No Votes for Genocide protest. This is Sophie, a student here in New York City.
I'm not voting for the capitalist ruling class, so I'm not voting for either Kamala or Trump. I don't think they do anything for my people. I'm half Bengali. Half of my family are Muslim Bengali immigrants, and they actually experienced their own genocide that was funded by the U.S., and I've never seen any of U.S. presidents do anything for the Global South, including Bangladesh, Pakistan, or any of the Middle East. The argument that a vote for Jill Stein or Claudia and Karina or third party is a vote for Trump is really frustrating. I think it's not a vote for Trump or Kamala. It's a vote for neither of them. And if Kamala loses, it's her own damn fault. You know, like, this is the one thing that's important to me. If she were to do anything for Palestine, I would consider voting for her.
So that was a protest that happened just on Saturday. And I wanted to end, Rami Khoury, by asking you about what happened after President Trump won and he got his congratulations from Benjamin Netanyahu. Just before that, he fired the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and he installed Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz, who proposed creating an artificial island off Gaza's coast where Palestinians could be forcibly relocated. Katz also called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the occupied territories, saying this is a war on all fronts and we must win it. Are you concerned under Trump that Netanyahu will follow through with annexing, for example, the West Bank?
Yes. I mean, we have to be concerned about Trump and Netanyahu and others doing really outrageous things. They've done them in the past and they'll do them again, unless somebody checks them. And this is the missing element in this situation in Palestine and in U.S., Israel, U.S., Middle East relations. The Israelis, Netanyahu is quite desperate right now, so he's doing desperate things like this, only appealing to his right-wing fascist extremists in government and to their supporters overseas who actually don't know much about the details of the situation but emotionally respond to this kind of process where Israel is strong and protects itself and defends itself. Yes, we have to be careful about what might happen. The response to the excesses of the Israelis—
We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah, the response has to be continued mobilization, protest, solidarity, and the justice for both Israelis and Palestinians simultaneously. That's the winning formula. And bring in Iran, and everybody will be on board happily, including the Saudis, too.
Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. Coming up, we look at some of the ballot initiatives that failed and won in this election season. Stay with us. All You Fascists Bound to Lose, performed by Rhiannon Giddens and the Resistance Revival Chorus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Historic ballot measures enshrining the right to an abortion passed in seven states: Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Montana, Maryland, New York, and Missouri, where voters backed a measure in Missouri that'll overturn one of the strictest abortion bans in the country that prohibits the procedure even in cases of rape and incest. Missouri was the first state to enact an abortion abortion ban after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. In Arizona, voters approved Prop 139 by a landslide, establishing a fundamental right to abortion and prohibiting state officials from restricting or banning abortion before 24 weeks of pregnancy. Similar ballot proposals failed in three states, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Florida, where a measure that would have rolled back the state's six-week abortion ban fell just short of the 60% needed to pass. They changed the rules to have to require a supermajority. It got something like 57 to 58% of the vote. In other ballot initiative news, Arizona voters passed a contested measure that would allow state and local law enforcement to arrest immigrants suspected of crossing the U.S.-Mexico border outside of ports of entry while empowering state judges to order deportations. The measure, which creates a series of new state crimes targeting immigrants, is modeled after a Texas law known as SB 4, currently under review by the Supreme Court. Three ballot measures that would have legalized recreational use of marijuana in Florida, North Dakota, and South Dakota failed. In labor rights, Alaska and Missouri approved measures increasing the minimum wage. Both measures would require employers to provide sick leave while establishing a minimum wage of $15 per hour. In California, voters have passed a so-called tough-on-crime ballot initiative that rolls back parts of a progressive law approved by voters in 2014, which downgraded several nonviolent crimes to misdemeanors. Prop 36 will make shoplifting a felony for repeat offenders and increase penalties for drug charges. We go now to Chris Melody Fields-Figueredo. She is executive director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center in D.C. Can you talk about what passed, what didn't, and what issues voters care about, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think you gave a really great summary, Amy, and I think really it's important for folks to know that the majority of Americans do support abortion rights and reproductive freedom, and that is some glimmer of hope for us to hold on to. Even in Florida, 57% of the vote, that's the majority of Floridians who said no to the extreme abortion ban, and there was so much hard work and organizing by incredible organizations in that state that has been doing that work for 2 years against all the odds, against the state, the governor, trying every single thing in their power to stop Amendment 4 in Florida. And I think what we're seeing across the country is similar, sort of these mixed results. But I think what we really have to focus on is the state work that lies ahead of us. You know, we did protect abortion rights. We did do really important things for workers with paid sick and raising the minimum wage in Massachusetts. It looks like the measure to allow unionization of workers from Uber and Lyft is going to be successful in Arizona. They actually stopped a state legislatively referred measure that would have made tip workers make less. So, and then it looks like we're also going to be able. It's looking good that we're going to win these three marriage equality measures in California, Hawaii, and Colorado. It's still a little too early in some of the western states. So, you know, I think there is a lot of hope for us, and I think the deep work that is going to be really necessary is to look at the issues, look how people voted for those issues. Maybe they voted at a higher rate to support reproductive freedom than maybe some of the Senate candidates or even the president. So I think those numbers in the next couple of days of as we do deeper analysis is really going to give us a path and a way forward and really thinking about what are the critical issues that people care about, what were the results, what worked, what didn't work, and that's going to build our path forward.
And Chris, would you say that there's been an increase in recent years in the use of ballot initiatives, and to what degree is it underappreciated in terms of a democratic check and balance by the people on the mm-hmm. gridlock of government?
Listen, we are living in a gerrymandered country in many states. You think about Ohio, Florida, many states. You know, we have gerrymandered districts. People grassroots organizations have turned to, you know, especially in Republican trifecta states, have turned to ballot measures to show that there is a different vision for their states, for their different, for their communities. We have been successful over the last several election cycles to pass progressive policy from Medicaid expansion to redistricting, even though it did fail in Ohio this year. That is because of the Republican-controlled ballot title board that gave really confusing language. Voters were confused. They thought they were voting to end gerrymandering, and then they turned around and because of the mis and disinformation, realized that they should have voted yes for issue one. So it is an underappreciated tool, and we get, you know, obviously I've been listening to the show today, and there's so much focus on the federal election and federal offices and candidates, but I actually think these issues are showing us what people care about, and that is so important for us to think about of what we need to be talking to everyday people, going into communities, understanding them, because they are telling us a different path forward. And because we are resisting, we are winning on these progressive issues, they are trying to take that power away from us. I think one of the highlights from last night is the fact that in Arizona and North Dakota, the state legislatures referred ballot measures that would have made it harder for citizens to put issues on the ballot. Voters rejected that, and we've seen that time and time again, is voters like to take this power and this agency. They actually understand their community sometimes better than, you know, the pundits and folks that, you know, do this as for a living. They understand their communities so well, and, you know, I think the work forward is also going to be defending direct democracy, making sure that the voter-approved measures around abortion and raising the minimum wage and sick leave, right, that those are moving forward and implemented. And then we are going to look at a really tough state legislative cycle in states like Missouri, in states like Florida, in states like Ohio, where they are going to try to undermine the will of the people and try to take this powerful tool away from us when we know this is actually how we stand up and fight back for our communities.
Could you talk about Proposition 131 in Colorado that failed, and this was a considered a stealth ranked choice voting initiative backed by dark money?
You know, I think there is a lot of, you know, people are still trying to understand ranked choice voting, open primaries, top two, top four. There's still a lot of education that needs to be done. I mean, here in Washington, D.C., Initiative 83 looks to have passed for ranked choice voting and open primaries. I think there's a lot of information that people don't quite understand. I know that was true also in states like Nevada. But then you have a state like Missouri. You know, that voted yes to stop some of the ramifications of Citizen United. And so I think ultimately what we are going to have to do in the next couple of days is try to do this deeper analysis, not just the hot takes right now, not just looking at exit polls, but really looking at the city level, the county level, who turned out, why they turned out on these different issues, and see what influenced them to understand how we are going to organize moving forward and fight back.
Finally, we just have 10 seconds, but do you think the whole ballot initiative movement will change under the second Trump presidency with increasing number of judges that he might appoint that would stop this kind of movement?
Listen, we've always at BIS believed that this is a fight for our democracy, that every one of these issues are, like, one of the things I have said is the fight for reproductive freedom is the fight for democracy. And so, yes, we are going to have to look at the courts. We are going to have to look at the state legislatures. And that is now us, the people that will go into state legislatures to fight back to make sure,
Chris,
that this tool is not taken away from us.
We're going to have to leave it there. Chris Melody Fields-Figueredo, Executive Director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. And that does it for today's two-hour election special. If you missed any hour, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for video news production. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.